Okay. We're back.
We're back in.
And we have a lot.
Yes, we do. I think.
So let's do it. So you had some things you wanted to start with.
Yeah, I read a little bit more about psychic driving. And last time when we talked about it, I had just said I looked it up briefly, and it turns out it seems to be a form of torture, but there's a lot more behind it that is both just interesting on its own. I think it would be a worthy topic for, actually there have been books written about it, and it's a really, really interesting subject, but also in the context of Hannibal, it's a really interesting subject. So psychic driving is a form basically of torture. It's a combination of sensory deprivation, sleep deprivation, repeated messages being played over and over again with the goal of kind of breaking someone down and implanting ideas in their heads. But it's attributed to this psychiatrist from the 50s, the person who really pioneered it, if you want to use the word pioneer for something that's such an awful practice, was this Canadian super psychiatrist named Dr. Ewan Cameron. And he was incredibly well known and incredibly influential in the psychiatric profession for a long time. He was the head of like every major psychiatric society in both the US and Canada. He was really, really at the top of his profession. It seems that he actually thought of himself or believed that he belonged in the company of Freud and Jung and the great, you know, the great practitioners. He became impatient with the process of talk therapy. And his belief was that through using technology, and the technology that was available at the time was things like reel-to-reel tape recorders, you know. He believed that through the use of technology, for example, playing the same message on a taped loop to someone over and over again, that you could get much faster results than through talk therapy. And he really believed in using these accelerants. So in the 50s, he was approached by the CIA to work on these studies. The CIA at the time in the 50s saw these soldiers coming back from the Korean War who had been prisoners of war, and they thought that these soldiers had been brainwashed, as in the Manchurian Candidate. And so the CIA became really interested in trying to figure out how to do that themselves. And this guy, Dr. Ewan Cameron, was approached by the CIA, and they started funding these psychic driving studies that he conducted at McGill University. And this funding was from that same MK Ultra initiative that the CIA was doing. Remember there was that Errol Morris show Wormwood a few years ago about that, this guy Frank Olson jumped out a window after they'd done a series of these LSD experiments on him. That division of the CIA that was funding that effort, this LSD experiment, MK Ultra was what it was called, and they were also funding this at the same time, funding this thing that Dr. Ewan Cameron was doing at McGill. So what he was doing was, and this is just happens to coincidentally relate a little bit to that book we're reading, The Great Pretender, about the way people get mistreated or historically got mistreated in psychiatric facilities. Like basically at that time, if you went into a psychiatric facility, you gave up all agency. It was worse than being in prison. It was worse than being a prisoner of war. Like once you were checked into a psychiatric facility, the facility staff could just run, could do anything they wanted to you. They could lobotomize you. They could drug you. They could give you electroshock therapy. They could just do all this crazy stuff. And so with this urging from the CIA, he just started taking patients who were checked into this facility at McGill and torturing them. And so he did these experiments on them. He gave them LSD. He gave them other drugs. he subjected them to sleep deprivation and sensory deprivation, and these repeated messages. And
is this also, can I just ask a question? Does this technique also one of those ones that use like strobe lights and like light and like keeping you in the dark and then putting you in the light and like that stuff that they did?
That kind of stuff. Okay. Yeah. That kind of stuff. So
just but all stuff that basically fucks with your head and makes you crazy.
That fucks with your head. Now, this was more of like kind of an effort to figure out how to brainwash people. So ostensibly, the point of this was for him to be able to figure out, with the CIA's help, for him to be able to figure out how to implant ideas in people's heads, which is relevant for this episode of Hannibal. But basically what he did was he did all these experiments on people, and it totally destroyed them. He would give the whole idea with electroshock therapy is you're supposed to give it very infrequently and let the patient have time to recover. He would do it multiple times a day, like 12 times a day he would give people the shock therapy. And he'd be giving them these drugs and doing the sleep deprivation stuff and be playing recorded messages to them over and over again. And basically what would happen to the subjects of these experiments is they would be completely broken. So they would go in for psychiatric treatment for whatever reason, but they were often perfectly, you know, fairly healthy people who just felt they needed to check themselves in for a little while. And they would come out and they couldn't read. They couldn't recognize family members. They would forget what had happened to them. They would forget the past. And they were just wrecked. So anyone who went through this basically came out incredibly diminished and unable to function. Some of them would even become incontinent and like couldn't take care of themselves in the most basic way. And this was sort of not really known about for a long time. And the reading that I did about it was a couple of articles that were decades apart. So one of them was actually something that David Remnick wrote for the Washington Post back in 1985. And the reason why he wrote about it then was because these records had been declassified or obtained through FOIA requests, and the families of the people who had suffered through these experiments years before were starting to sue. So they were suing the CIA, and so it was a little bit of a thing back then in the 80s. And Dr. Ewan Cameron's psychic driving, this terminology, was kind of in the ether back then when these lawsuits were going on in the mid-80s. And then it sort of resurfaces again, in the mid-2000s when the U.S. government was starting to subject, you know, suspected terrorists to this stuff at Guantanamo and all that. So basically, they kind of took this psychic driving playbook and started just redoing it for other reasons. I think they were actually trying to like get confessions out of people, right? So they were using these same methods of breaking people down and basically torturing them so that they could implant ideas in their head so they would confess to being part of terrorist organizations or whatever it was. So I guess everything old is new again. You know, these were horrible, horrible practices. And the interesting thing about Ewan Cameron again is he thought he was going to be
in the pantheon of great psychiatrists,
the pantheon of the very greats, and not unlike Chilton, right? So in the context of the Hannibal discussion, Chilton wants to use psychic driving to accelerate his reputation and sort of belong in the pantheon of these or be a peer to people like Hannibal and others, and he so desperately wants to. Dr. Cameron died of a heart attack when he was relatively young, so this stuff didn't really come out in his lifetime. So it was really only later that all this information started coming out. So it's horrible, and actually, it's just a terrible story, right? Like removing all the agency, removing people's agency, destroying them with funding from the CIA, and then the CIA later backed. They just ruined all these people's lives, and we still do it, right? The U.S. government still does it. We're doing it right now, like to women in ICE facilities, right? Just giving them hysterectomies for no reason. It's like it's as soon as an institution has control of someone,
yep,
the institution will abuse them.
Yes, yes.
And ruin them. And it's just such a consistent thing, you know, year after year, all through human history. It's really crazy. But anyway, this MK Ultra stuff was what was behind the psychic driving. So it is appropriate that Hannibal would recognize it. So in the context of Hannibal, it's kind of interesting because Hannibal sort of did this a little bit with Abigail Hobbs, right?
With the mushroom tea.
With the mushroom tea. He wasn't really implanting ideas in her head, but you could say maybe he was, right? He was making her comfortable with operating in kind of like a different mode and a different set of morals that he was kind of pushing on her, right? Because she was on the cusp of saying, you know, of like wondering whether she was going to be a moral person or whether there was something really wrong with her. And Hannibal drugs her and basically says, hey, there's something wrong with you, but it's okay, right?
I think what we've seen Hannibal do is not, with Abigail and with others, is not, I don't think would fall squarely into this idea of psychic driving. Because with like Abigail, he's just put her in a state that makes her more susceptible to suggestion. He's certainly not, you can't say that he has rendered her into a state of complete incompetence and is implanting ideas like using sleep deprivation or repeated messages. He's put her in a state of susceptibility. And so far with other people, we've just seen him driving them in a manipulative way. Like he is so insightful and able to see what people's motives are and weaknesses are and vulnerabilities are that he can very easily exploit them and capitalize on them.
Right.
But go ahead.
No, I think the show is taking some artistic license with the term psychic driving. It's hard to imagine that Chilton would be able to get away with subjecting Gideon to sleep, to sensory deprivation and really, really torturing him. So we don't really know what he did to him to get him to believe that he's the Chesapeake Ripper, but we do know that it's not moral, right?
Yeah.
And that he's pushing the boundaries of, he's pushing the ethical boundaries to do whatever it is he's doing. And Hannibal gives him approval of it.
Yes.
And again, I thought it was an interesting parallel to this Ewan Cameron story, because Cameron was doing this to try to increase his reputation and gain the acceptance of his peers or whatever it was. And Hannibal is saying to Chilton, it's okay that you did this horrible thing. I accept it. I think it's fine. And I would have done it myself.
Yes.
Right. So I think there's some artistic license. It's hard to imagine that Chilton would have really tortured him. But like the idea is that he did something incredibly unethical to push Gideon into this belief.
Yes, it seems like if there was, you know, if they were talking about psychic driving to the extent that you've described it as in reality, one would think Alana's reaction to Hannibal saying there's reasonable uses for it to be more than her saying like, oh, really? Like what? Like when would it be reasonable? Like you would just think there would be a much more angry or stunned or startled reaction.
She'd get up and leave.
Yes.
Right? Like,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's really fascinating. And one of the things I had thought about when I was looking back at this episode and rewatching this episode, in an episode where they first introduced the concept of psychic driving and we first meet Miriam Less, what I had forgotten about but came back to me is that Hannibal psychically drives Miriam, because later, if you recall, when Miriam comes back, she seems to, I think there's some questions about.
She's wrecked, yeah.
But also she has been, it seems, I think there's some question about what's going on at the beginning, whether she's working with Hannibal or has been brainwashed not to recognize him or his voice. But right. she doesn't identify him as the person who held her captive and later identify someone else as the person who held her captive. Right. And I don't recall whether we see any flashbacks of him psychically driving her or it's stated or we just make that conclusion from the outcome that happens to Miriam. But they're talking about psychic driving and they're specifically talking about psychic driving of Dr. Gideon, but it's in the episode when we see Hannibal's first interaction with Miriam Lass and it foreshadows what will be done to Miriam Lass.
Yeah, so once again, when Hannibal's talking about the behavior of others, he's actually talking about things that he's done. And yes. he does this constantly.
Yes.
He's just always, always at it. Isn't that interesting? Yes. And horrible and yes. really interesting.
It's a terrible, terrible story. It's a terrible, terrible story. Like many terrible stories about what were done to people who had agency taken from them.
Well, it's like this book, The Great Pretender, we're reading. It's just all about how degraded, what a degrading experience it is to be
psychiatrically
institutionalized, and how much agency you lose when that happens, and then how anyone who has influence over you will just push it so far to abuse the hell out of people and treat them like lab rats. It's really, really, it just happens over and over and over again. Like the Stanford Prison Experiment too, right? Like it just gets proven over and over again that you give someone a little bit of power over somebody else and they'll really, really take it too far. Anyway, yeah, isn't that really interesting?
I love it. Yeah, I mean, I don't love it. It's sad, but I really love learning about it. It's fascinating and terrible. And very relevant to, obviously our discussion.
Yep.
So just switching gears a little, one thing I was thinking about a lot after we finished our last discussion, and really thinking about even before I rewatched the episode, was our conversation about the contrast between what Hannibal has done as the Chesapeake Bay Ripper and how he handles Miriam, and whether Hannibal's really a sadist as opposed to somebody who's, sort of expressing dominance, who's cold and calculating, who approaches murder in a different way than a pure sadist. So I just thought about, there were two things I wanted to discuss about this. One is sort of a practical issue, and one is more of an emotional and psychological issue. So I think part of the reason for the difference here as a practical matter is that he actually isn't killing Miriam, right? Mm. He's putting Miriam in a sleeper hold is what appears to me to be happening. And when you put someone in a sleeper hold, so can I just get a little also instructional here?
Sure.
So I think people think, when you strangle somebody, like forensically it's referred to as neck compression. Mm-hmm. And it can do, you can basically kill someone two different ways. One is by cutting off their breath, and the other is by cutting off blood flow between the brain and the heart. Mm-hmm. The really typical way it happens is not cutting off breath, because to do that, you have to be reaching the trachea and the larynx, and they're very, very deep in the structures of the neck. Mm-hmm. Whereas the veins that you have to compress to induce hypoxia, which is when you impede blood flow to and from the brain isn't getting sufficient oxygen, and eventually it stops your heart. Mm-hmm. So that's the typical way strangulation or neck compression causes death. You have and so this is just something that's always a pet peeve of mine, and it's funny that it didn't occur to me when I was watching Hannibal. And I think part of the reason it didn't occur to me is because I'd already accepted we're in a different universe. But I have a pet peeve because when I see strangulation in television shows or in movies, like strangulation takes a long time to accomplish.
Right.
And the reason it takes a long time to accomplish is if you've cut off blood flow and the brain isn't getting oxygen, when you release the hold, the blood flow starts again and you come back to consciousness. You're not dead. So in order to actually strangle someone to death, you have to do it long enough to achieve loss of consciousness and then continue to strangle the person while they're unconscious. And there are no real studies on how long this takes because you can't study by strangling a human to unconsciousness and death, like it's obviously. Right. But
yeah, maybe Dr. Ewan Cameron might have.
Yes.
If but, the CIA paid him to.
But forensic pathologists sort of estimate this, that it takes at least a minute to 2 minutes after loss of consciousness to kill someone by neck compression. So it takes a long time. So, you know, in TV and movies, I'm always just like, that person isn't dead. Like, the person would never be dead. The guy's been strangling him for 2 seconds, right?
Right.
In Hannibal, I think because I'm familiar with those tropes anyway, and I'm used to seeing them on TV. And
you're also, I should just note for anyone who's listening, you know a lot about this for professional reasons.
Yes, yes.
Right,
yes.
Right.
So I think when I saw this, normally I would have had a reaction to it to say, ugh, she can't be dead. Like, he's been strangling her for 2 seconds. But because I've already immersed in this place where the rules of the real world don't apply to Hannibal, it didn't bother me and it didn't strike me. But when you think about this, that the fact that he's putting her in a sleeper hold, and a sleeper hold really does work by just inducing loss of consciousness by compressing the jugular vein or the carotid artery or both. The jugular takes blood away from the brain to the heart. The carotid brings it from the heart to the brain. So if you compress one, either of those or both of those, you'll induce loss of consciousness fairly quickly. But you have to be, if that's what your intention is, and your intention isn't to kill, you have to be extremely careful. So that's a reason, that's a practical reason for Hannibal's apparent weirdly gentle or tender actions towards
her. He's calibrating his...
Yes. Right. Yes. And of course, this is why you'll see in many of these police chokehold cases where somebody dies, it's because they've held the thing too long or they've held it too hard.
Right.
So I think that's one reason he's taking the care he knows he needs to take if his intention is not to kill her. He's putting her to sleep. But I think there is some emotional tenderness there, because he does kind of cradle her and kiss her head. And there is sort of a weird sense of he's putting her to sleep like a child or a baby. And so anyway, that's just kind of a practical reason that there's a certain tenderness and gentleness going on, or what appears to be a certain tenderness and gentleness going on.
Right.
The other thing I thought about in terms of whether Hannibal is like a sadist or why is he doing this in this way, and what was occurring to me is that he is taking pleasure in pain the way a sadist does. But Hannibal, I think part of what Hannibal wants to do, one thing is just creating art. And part of the artistic creation and part of the artistic experience is to provoke emotion or to provoke a reaction or to provoke a feeling. Like, that's what creators of art really do, right? And that's what viewers of art. So, like, I was just thinking how we are complicit in this, right? Like, as we talked about, like, we are watching this show. We watch horror because it evokes a reaction in us and an emotion in us, and it makes us feel a kind of way, feel a certain way. We might not want to see that in real life, but we want to see it on the screen because it induces an emotion in us. And I think for Hannibal, in creating this art, he does want to see a range of human emotion. Like, he wants to see it because he doesn't have it in him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of what this is. It's not right. It's not just about getting pleasure from pain. It's about the gamut
right.
of human emotion.
Which would contribute to why he likes Will Graham so much, because Will Graham like feels the emotion of these situations so acutely, and Hannibal can watch it happen. And also why Hannibal would enjoy being part of this FBI team so much, because he gets to see how other people react to killing and also his own killings. Like this is a nice opportunity for him in that way, for him to see how other people are reacting to his art.
Yes. And I also thought what was interesting in this episode is that we learned that Hannibal used to be a practicing doctor, like a surgeon or a medical mm-hmm. doctor. And right. you can kind of think that maybe the So Dr. Gideon, at one point when he's being asked about the trophies, the organ trophies, and why, you know, he never did that before, and he says there's something like there's limits to what you can do in an operating room,
mm-hmm.
like you can't take organs out of an operating room.
Right.
But I kind of thought this applies to Hannibal in some sense. There must have been limits for him in an operating room, basically.
Right.
And I thought it's very interesting that he switched to psychiatry, because psychiatry would allow him to experience people's emotions and their emotional pain in another way than he was able to as a practicing medical doctor.
Yeah, that's really a really good thought about why we're explicitly told that he used to be a medical doctor and then moved into psychiatry. That's I love it.
So that was something I was thinking about. The other thing I was thinking about is, since killing is his art and creating these murder tableaus is his art, like an artist, Hannibal's art evolves, right? It's not just staying one thing all the time. And we know that the Chesapeake Ripper hasn't killed in this way in 2 years. Now, maybe that's partly because, somebody was onto his tail, but also his artistic expression of murder may simply be evolving and changing right. and being inspired by different things and to fulfill different artistic needs.
And Miriam, when Miriam's observing the Chesapeake Ripper victim, she kind of hints at that, right? She does seem to think this isn't a normal serial killer
right.
who's going to be predictable.
Right, exactly. This leads me to the thing that I emailed you about yesterday or texted you about yesterday.
St. Sebastian.
Yes. So during the rewatch, when I looked at Hannibal's sketch, the one that Miriam last sees, and let me just preface this by saying, like, while you and I both love Hannibal, obviously there are many, many, many fans and academics who have delved far more deeply into Hannibal than we ever have. So I know that a lot of what we're discussing and what seems new to us and what seem like, you know, like eureka moments for us are probably things that have been thought about and chewed over by other people before. But
yes.
for me, when I saw that sketch, and I think this is probably one of the things that other people have discussed, you know, in detail.
At length, yeah.
Yes, I'm guessing. But so when I saw the sketch, I looked at it and I just said, oh, it's Saint Sebastian. And we weren't raised Catholic. I wasn't brought up knowing about the lives of saints. I do have a kind of an interest in the lives of saints, but it's not something that's ever, you know, it's the kind of thing where if I'm traveling and I'm in a church and it's a saint something, I may get interested in reading about that saint. But, you know, it's never been like one of my many, many obsessions that I've just sat down and immersed myself in. But I did learn about Saint Sebastian, and I learned about it in another fandom. And I learned about it, well, I'll just stop us there. But I did learn about it. I learned about Saint Sebastian from another fandom. And that's why I was able to recognize him. So let me just briefly tell you what I know about Saint Sebastian. I guess I'll start out saying that Saint Sebastian in more modern times has sort of been adopted or taken up as a gay icon.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of reasons, which I'll get to. But the story of Saint Sebastian, and I think it all really relates to this episode, is Saint Sebastian was a Roman soldier, but he was hiding the fact that he was Christian. So he's a person who is hiding their identity, much as, for example, Hannibal does. He's hiding mm-hmm. his true nature. I mean, with Hannibal, it's an evil nature, and with Saint Sebastian, it's not. When his Christianity is discovered, he is apparently bound, and archers shoot arrows at him until he's like basically porcupined with arrows. Mm-hmm. He miraculously survives this. He's taken in by someone who helps heal him, and he emerges and lives again, and then he's later martyred and clubbed to death. Mm. So Saint Sebastian in artistic depictions, and I'll just say, we have somebody who we believe to be dead, Miriam, who we will later find out is alive. Mm-hmm. So that's another parallel. Saint Sebastian, it seems to me, was a departure in his artistic depiction, in that the saints previously were sort of like kind of rough, hairy guys. And mm-hmm. Saint Sebastian was depicted in art as a beautiful man with a hairless body, with his musculature of his torso very defined, wearing mm-hmm. like a loincloth, and with the arrows in him, with his sort of face in an expression of ecstasy. Mm-hmm. So over the years, he just a lot of different kinds of artists, like filmmakers, writers, painters, sculptors, have either interpreted Saint Sebastian in art in a way that makes allusions to homosexuality, mm-hmm. and later on that overtly describe it as describe him as homosexual. This also was something that became very significant during the early days of AIDS, because Saint Sebastian was the patron saint of plagues. He and part of the reason people think he was originally painted in this way was to show he had not succumbed to plagues that were prevalent at the time. Mm-hmm. So when the AIDS crisis began, it was another moment of him being taken up as a gay icon, because he was the patron saint to protect you from plagues. Mm. So I just thought this is very interesting, because first of all, it's a direct allusion to homosexuality and homoeroticism that is inspiring Hannibal's art at this time. The killings mm-hmm. he's doing as the Chesapeake Bay Ripper are inspired by this homoeroticism. And so there's something interesting about that to me, and also about the fact that the depiction of Saint Sebastian in art has evolved over time. And you know, I don't know if I sent you this article, but there was an article just showing older depictions of Saint Sebastian up to new ones that are just very overt depictions of him as a gay man. Mm. And also, there's an interpretation of his experience as being penetrated and taking pleasure in pain. Because mm-hmm. he's penetrated by these arrows, and his face is sort of one of serenity or ecstasy mm-hmm. at experiencing the pain. And I think this is, you know, it's clearly the inspiration for what Hannibal is doing, and is also an example of a kind of art that evolves over time. Mm. So I just thought that was really fascinating, and I had kind of just missed that it was Saint Sebastian on previous viewings.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things that strike me about that too, in that if Chilton was psychically driving Gideon to kill the nurse in this way, you know, you wonder how could he have conveyed so much detail about the Chesapeake Ripper murders to Gideon, but if they're all knowledgeable about these things, he very well could have just suggested Saint Sebastian to Gideon, right?
Go ahead.
And if Gideon was familiar enough with like the history and the art and the way he's pierced, maybe that would have been a shortcut to suggesting that sort of style of murder. Now, I do know that Gideon seems to kill the nurse in exactly the same way that the Chesapeake Ripper killed others, or the pattern of, you know, all the stabbing, all the objects in the body and all that were supposed to be exactly like it. So I guess maybe my theory falls down a little bit there, but.
See, I think Gideon was just following what the Chesapeake Bay Ripper murders looked like, because we know that he desecrated the body post-mortem. And that the
But Jack says no details of it were ever released. So I was trying to think what would be a way of Chilton conveying the details to
Chilton worked on the case.
Right.
Chilton worked on the case early on.
So there's no telling how much he told Gideon.
Correct. Yeah. But this is just another thing that another reason, if you want to just talk about why Hannibal is doing something that's obviously incredibly brutal, incredibly sadistic, incredibly violent, as to do this to the bodies while they're alive. If he's being inspired by Saint Sebastian, that's how it was done to Saint Sebastian, mm-hmm. right? And if he wants to recreate that inspiration in some form, one would think he would keep do it while the bodies were alive.
Right. Now, there's also a little bit of a meta point here, too, that's worth mentioning. You learned about Saint Sebastian in a Slash fandom, right?
Yes.
And Hannibal itself is sort of...
Yes.
A Slash... work of Slash fandom in a way, right? Like, what if Will Graham and Hannibal were lovers?
Yes, yes. Yes, exactly. I mean, it's its own interpretive work that also was responsive to a Slash fandom, right? Also, so there's a lot of interplay,
right? Yeah, which is, we were talking about this much earlier about our having seen Brian Fuller interact with fans, just how much of a fan he seems to be.
Yes.
Like, this seems to be as much of a fandom for him as it is a creation.
Yes, yes, exactly. I mean, I don't know. I think I sent you an interview with him the other day. He had a recent interview. I think it was in Rolling Stone. I'm not sure. Where he really talked about how he's gone on to make movies and doesn't want to come back to television, except that he would kill to come back to do a fourth season of Hannibal because he has it entirely worked out. I just don't know why somebody wouldn't jump on.
Wouldn't that. Pick it up? Why wouldn't Netflix just pick it up?
Yeah, it's one of those things that, I mean, I sort of trust Brian Fuller that he wouldn't do it unless it was really good, but it is one of those things that's a little scary because you just don't want the kind of perfection of this series to be tainted by something not as good.
Yeah, it's true. You just wonder, with so many years in between, would it have the same sense of momentum and kind of sense of place in the weird world that he's created? Like, would you be able to recapture it years later? But I don't know. I'd love to see it.
Me too.
Obviously.
So, setting those sort of two larger issues, those two big things aside, there were a few things I noticed during the rewatch that I wanted to point out and discuss and get your reaction to. One is, when they arrive at the hospital, there's this very noticeable little red sports car parked in front of the hospital. And I'm assuming it's Chilton's.
It's gotta be.
Right? I don't know if we ever see him in it or we see him driving it, but it's just like this flashy, showy. It stands out so much because the hospital is so grim and dark.
Right.
So that was one thing. I did want to mention that I had talked about I knew Raul Esparza from Broadway musicals, and I didn't know what his career was on television, but apparently he's been on one of the Law and Order series for like 8 years. So I guess he had a career on television at the same time of as this or before this and after this. Oh, I wanted to ask you something. When Miriam Less is wandering around Hannibal's office, there's a fencing mask on the wall. And do we ever see him fencing, or am I just thinking, well, there's a fencing mask on his wall, and that's something Hannibal would obviously be great at?
I don't think we ever see him fencing, but let's watch for it. I don't think we see him fencing.
Oh, and one other thing, just going back to the evolution of Hannibal's art, I just think going forward, we should really keep an eye out to what he's saying in his murders, because I think there's always some kind of emotional or psychological message in his murders, and we should see. I mean, eventually he's going to turn a body into a heart that he gives to Will. So there's a message in the murder.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so here's a couple of things. After Will has the recreation of the murder of the nurse, and he comes out of it and he's very shaken up, I notice that he's rubbing his thumb on his cheek, on his upper cheek. It's not the same, but a similar gesture to the one Hannibal makes when he's angrily reading the article in. Good. So I just thought that was a link between the two of them.
Yeah, yeah. And actually the way Hannibal's kind of, now that you mention it, the way Hannibal sort of moving his fingers while he's reading that article looks a lot like the way Will is moving his fingers when he's pulling the fork tine out of his palm.
Yes, yes,
when he's
yes.
imitating the murder, Gideon's murder.
That's exactly right, yes. Okay, another disgusting thing about Chilton, I forgot about this, is that he implies that Dr. Gideon's been having sexual fantasies about Alana. Like, he's like, oh, he certainly remembers you.
I know. He's disgusting.
He's gross.
He's disgusting. I mean, people treat Alana this way, though, right? Like, and Gideon does say something to her about it.
I would have remembered someone so sublime, he says.
Yeah, yeah.
But, ugh.
It's
yes,
gross.
But like, okay, that's a guy who's a murderer in a mental institution saying that to her. He's not the doctor, colleague, peer of somebody saying that. Like, ugh. Okay. The scene where Will and Alana are separately interviewing Dr. Gideon, I just really paid attention to that scene, and it's like they have the camera glides back and forth between them, which really increases the feeling that the conversation is taking place at the same time. I just thought it was, I hadn't noticed it, but like it's so well done.
It's a great scene.
It just it gives you the feeling of just flow.
And that Alana and Will are really in sync in the way they're doing this work together.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, yes. There is a shot of Miriam and Jack in a flashback when they're looking at the Ripper victim, and it's just a shot. It's just the two of their heads in the shot. That shot immediately cuts to a shot just of Will and Jack's heads looking at the fake Ripper victim. So I think they're making it's just another example of them making a comparison between Miriam and Will and Jack's relationship to them.
Yeah, and Jack's head is in the exact same position in the frame.
Yep.
It dissolves to a new shot of him, but it's the exact same positioning. Yeah,
yes,
it's a really good shot.
Although it's interesting because in the shot with Jack and Miriam, she's looking at the body, not at Jack. When they cut to Jack and Will, Jack's head's in the same position, but Will is looking at Jack.
Right.
It's just it shows a difference in their relationships, I think, but also the similarities in their relationships.
Yep.
When Jack is screwing around, when he's manipulating Miriam Lass into going and looking at these medical records illegally, he keeps telling her, go back to your class. You should be learning about the exclusionary rule, which is basically the exclusionary rule, I just wanted to point out, is the rule that excludes illegally obtained evidence from being used in court.
Right, right. And by the way, he psychically drives her a little here. We talked about this a little bit last time, but he breaks her down.
Yes.
Right? He insults her, he degrades her, and then pulls her back from the brink when she's softened up.
It's a little bit like what people...
And makes her do something, makes her do something that she normally might not do after softening her up.
It's a little bit what like what people say domestic abusers do, right? Mm-hmm. They like break you down and then build you back up. They break you down and build you back up. And the part where they're building you back up and complimenting you is what keeps the other person in the relationship. Mm-hmm. So, okay, the building where they find Miriam's arm and the
observatory.
Yeah, it's an observatory, but it's a defunct observatory. It's an observatory where the telescope isn't working. So the ability to see is impaired or completely impeded. And then the question is asked, what do you see? And the cut from there is to, like, the thing that helps you see is not working to help you see. And that it cuts to Jack saying to Hannibal that the Ripper wanted to cloud my vision with hope. So I like that.
It's also not the last time we're going to see sort of an observatory-like structure in the show. Right? Later on, there's that God's Eye brain silo, right?
Yes, yes. Love your work. I forgot that Hannibal tells Jack about Bella, the world's a better place with her in it.
Yes.
And that's another Silence of the Lambs reference, obviously, that we didn't, we just didn't mention, so I just thought I'd mention it.
There's also another one, by the way, that when we first meet Chilton, first of all, when we first meet Chilton, he's doing a bit of an imitation of Chilton in Silence of the Lambs, right? Like, you know who he is immediately from kind of like the just odious tone of his voice. In that scene, he's got a pen in his pocket and the clip on the pen is very brightly lit. And in Silence of the Lambs, the pen clip is the piece of metal that Hannibal conceals and uses to uncuff himself. So I think that was, and it's really shining there in his pocket. So I don't think that was accidental.
I noticed it too, because I didn't think about that, but I noticed the pen because I just thought, this is a guy who's trying to dress snazzy, and like, why would he like ruin the look with the clip of a pen sticking out?
It's a reference to his pen clip.
That makes
in
sense.
Silence. Yep.
We had talked about how Hannibal decides at the when he's sitting at the desk that he's going to kill Miriam, and I just sort of looked. I was watching that scene, and Miriam says, "Your name was on the log." And Hannibal says, it was. And then he says, let me think. And I think it's like, just let me think for 1 second about what I have to do here. And I think that's the precise moment it happens.
Got it.
So those were some of the things I noticed. One thing I wanted to ask you.
Yes.
Is what do you think Hannibal's long game is with Miriam? Like, why at that point is he not just killing her? Why does he decide to keep her alive and then go on to keep her alive for 2 years? Like, what is his motivation at that time? Like, is he just trying to keep, does he just sort of have some instinct or thought that this could be useful to him later? Like, I just don't, how far in the future is he projecting?
It could also be that, it could be that he thinks because she's an FBI agent, that her whereabouts could, controlling her whereabouts could come in handy. He certainly wants to take her off the grid, but maybe he feels like he could learn something from her. I wonder too if we're going to see him develop this habit of keeping people alive while eating parts of their body. Maybe this is just the dawn of that new phase of cannibalism for him, that he enjoys, that he's starting to think that he'd rather than kill people and eat them right away, he wants to keep them around, and maybe he's kind of experimenting with that a little. Maybe he just has, in the same way that he sort of can pivot really easily when it's when circumstances change, maybe this is that. Maybe he's just like, this person's, you know, it's like what he says about Bella or what he says about Clarice Starling. This world is a more interesting place with you in it. And he just wants to keep her in the world because he thinks it might lead to something.
Yeah, and I also always think, and I just have not a very good memory. I know this is in the books. I didn't read all of the Thomas Harris books, but I mean, his sister becomes a figure in the series.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about his sister, and we're going to learn more about his sister. And I just wonder if, when he encounters sort of these young women like Abigail or Miriam Lass, there's a connection that he feels or he makes with his sister.
That's very smart, right? I had forgotten that his sister becomes such a thing. Yeah, that's it. That's it. It's an important type of relationship to him.
But I just don't, you know, I just don't remember enough about the sister to talk about it, to think about what the specifics are that are similar. And, you know, because it obviously wouldn't happen with any young woman. Although to date, the women that Hannibal we've seen him kill. Well, who have we seen him kill? We know, like, did the Ripper kill women?
I don't know if we know that for sure.
I mean, we know the one person that we're talking about is the hunter, who's a man.
Right.
We've seen Hannibal chase down.
Oh, and by the way, back to Saint Sebastian, the hunter shoots an arrow through his own leg, right?
Yes.
We forgot that.
Yes. Yeah. Which may have been why that's the person Hannibal fixated on.
Right.
He'd already had an arrow piercing him.
Right.
Well,
right.
That's 100% right.
Yeah.
I'm so happy.
It's all coming together.
Uh-huh. I'm just wondering about how often Hannibal kills women. I mean, we know he killed Cassie Boyle, but that was to illustrate, that was to be a copycat murder to illustrate something for Will about the Shrike, to help Will learn about the Shrike.
Yeah, that's true.
And then he killed that friend of Abigail's, and that was kind of that was sort of a, less for pleasure than for accomplishing something, right?
But he used it to advance his goals.
Yes. But I'm just wondering about the more of his art killings. Do they involve? I don't know. I guess we'll see as we go along. That may just be, you know.
He does cultivate long term relationships with women. Where mm-hmm. I mean, he does. Like he's Will is like the only man that. Well, no, he cultivates a relationship with Jack, but it's different. He has this, he seems to like to fill his life with women that he manipulates in different ways.
Bedelia, Abigail, yeah. Alana.
Yeah, I think we're about to meet Bedelia too.
I think so too. I'm excited. there was one other thing I just wanted to bring up with you, which is, you know, you were talking about how inducing fear in his victims would be counterproductive to his cooking, and that it may just be that we're not in a real universe. But then also I just thought, he kills people who are distasteful to him and then makes them tasteful.
Right.
And that may just be something he wants to do.
Right. So it's less a punishment for them being distasteful and more of a compulsion to transform them.
Which he loves to do. Becoming, transforming.
Yeah, good. Now, I had a couple of things, just a couple of small things that you had brought up that I thought a little bit more about.
Yep.
The Norton grape.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't read a ton about it, but it looks like it is. It's an interesting grape in that it's, besides the characteristics he points out, that the skin is the same color as the flesh, it's an American grape. I don't know if that really means anything, but it's not a European import or anything like that, or an import from another country. It's an American native variety. And I thought it was kind of cool that he peels it in front of Chilton, and Chilton's like, a grape with nothing to hide. which is a loaded moment, mm-hmm. and obviously because so much stuff is being hidden and revealed. Mm-hmm. I thought there's a close-up of Hannibal peeling a little bit of the skin with a knife, mm-hmm. which is a very surgical, that's not an easy thing to do, and it's surgically precise, and I almost feel like he's toying with Chilton a little bit, like saying, look how good I am with a knife, look how surgically precise I can be. It's almost like a tell if Chilton were looking for it. And later, Hannibal is going to be responsible for removing Chilton's skin, right?
Oh, yes.
So
Chilton really doesn't have a good outcome.
Oof, oof. Oh boy.
I'm sorry.
It's terrible, but Hannibal is going to skin him, so to speak, later. So I think it's foreshadowing there.
Very loaded foreshadowing. I hadn't thought of that.
And it's barely like Hannibal, going back to the thing where, you know, Hannibal's makes the, where Chilton says something about flamingos' tongues, and Hannibal's, well, you should be careful because your tongue seems pretty, like, that's a flat out really weird thing to say, uh-huh. right? Like, he basically says, careful or I'll kill you and eat your tongue. Like, it's like a really weird, weird, excessive thing to say. And I think we already know, Hannibal already is like, I'm not afraid of this person at all. And I'm definitely, definitely killing this person. Uh-uh. Like, right. Like there's, uh-huh. and he's not even afraid of him, even slightly.
Oh, go ahead.
No, and then one other thing, we had talked about the tie that Hannibal's wearing when Miriam first meets him. And how it's a big broad tie with big botanical print on it, and it's white against his, and it's really contrasts with his suit. I felt like maybe it was kind of a, like, nature's way of saying stay away. Like it's almost alarming. Like he's a poison tree frog or something like that. Like it's just this bright, like, whoa, get, like, it's alarming, and it might even, you know, if she was looking for it, she might have said, stay away. That's just a warning sign, a botanical or a natural warning sign, because it does seem like, so it does just hit you in the face. Mm-hmm. Also, the lapels on his jacket that he's wearing in that scene are really pointy and prominent, and they seem like sharp edge. They almost seem like knives. So I kind of thought that wardrobe choice of having this alarming tie and these lapels that are so prominent and pointy that they could cut you is kind of saying that it's a form of alert that she just doesn't notice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I watched this, you know, I watched the scene again of Hannibal going up the ladder and then coming down and killing yeah. her. It's just so good. You could watch it 100 times, but it's definitely, you're absolutely correct that they really emphasize the clop, clop, clop up the ladder. And it's clearly meant to convey that Hannibal's doing this intentionally. I mean, afterwards, mm-hmm. it's clear he did it intentionally to kind of subconsciously let her know she's going to hear him when he comes down, when in yep. fact she's not going to hear him. Yep. So she's just sort of, he's disorienting her about what's really, about his actual approach
yep.
and hiding it. And it's just fantastic.
It's great. And it's also one of the more overtly kind of horror movie-ish sequences in the show so far.
It's just a really very well done special kind of scene.
All right, what do you think? We're an over an hour into yes. this part two.
I think we're gonna have to split this episode up into two parts because I don't know that there's any human in the universe other than ourselves that want to listen to us talking for 2 hours. So maybe that's what we should do.
Okay.
Okay. And we'll be back next time with episode 7, Sorbet.
All right.